This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
After years of economic decline and racial tension, a city in Maine that has become a popular landing spot for Somali refugees came together a couple of years ago over a very special soccer team and a very special game.
It's a high school that had to learn to adapt and accommodate and negotiate. And one of the places where that happens is on the soccer field.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear how one team, one coach, and one goal united this New England community. Then we'll stay in New England with a conversation about the rising cost of college in Massachusetts and the rising amount of student debt it's causing. And we'll spend an academic minute looking for a right to education. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Lewiston, Maine was a classic New England mill town that, at the beginning of this century, had fallen on hard times. More than half the city's children lived below the poverty line. Then in 2001, the city took in thousands of Somali refugees, which added racial tension to the picture. In her new book called One Goal, A Coach, A Team, and the Game That Brought a Divided Town Together, Amy Bass tells the story of the Lewiston Blue Devils and how some of those young refugees helped win the first state soccer title in Lewiston's history. Amy Bass is a journalist and Emmy-winning sports reporter for NBC. She's also a professor of history at the College of New Rochelle in New York. I asked her why she wanted to tell this story.
I am a graduate, a proud graduate of Bates College, which is in Lewiston, Maine, and that's where this story takes place. So Lewiston's always on my radar. I lived there for 4 years, years before this story takes place, but a college friend who stayed in Maine had posted a small article about this soccer team on her Facebook page, of all places, and I read it, and this is exactly the kind of stuff I'm looking for. I'm looking for ways to write about sports in which the story transcends sports. So this soccer team in this city was really appealing to me.
Tell us somewhat about Lewiston, Maine. What kind of a city was it? What kind of a city has it been transformed into?
Sure. Lewiston, Maine is a classic New England factory town. It was a textile center. Spindle City was its nickname. And in the 19th century, some Boston capitalists made their way there to harness the power of the Androscoggin River. So it's a city that, you know, its history is sort of inscribed in its landscape, its canals siphoning off the water from the Androscoggin, and red brick factory buildings, which were thriving until really the bottom fell out of the manufacturing industry and the factories left town. And what was left behind were the people that had come for those jobs, which they'd come from the north. It's an immigration story from the north, French Canadians coming down to Lewiston. So Lewiston was a city that sort of had its eyes in its rearview mirror for a long time. And then in 2001, a handful of Somali families landed there. And that handful was followed by hundreds, and those hundreds were followed by thousands.
So it's really been transformed into a very almost cosmopolitan city, you could say.
The center street is Lisbon Street, and Lisbon Street was once this thriving center, one of the largest retail landscapes outside of Boston in New England. And that got, you know, when I was a college student, it was very shuttered. It was some pawn shops and what have you. And now it's this mom and pop shops are back, but not as I think anyone envisioned. It's a lot of immigrant business dreams that are supplying foods and clothing and culture to support the community that's there now.
Of course, your story centers around the high school soccer team. What kind of a school is it? And talk about the kids you met.
Yeah, Lewiston High School is one of the largest in Maine, a hockey powerhouse, a cheerleading powerhouse, and now a soccer powerhouse. Lewiston has some of the poorest neighborhoods in Maine, so it's a high school that deals with all of the kinds of things that go along with the achievement gap caused by just decades and decades of intergenerational white poverty. With the influx of the Somali community, it's a high school that had to learn to adapt and accommodate and negotiate. And one of the places where that happens is on the soccer field, because These kids played soccer. They played soccer in the refugee camps where they lived in Kenya. They play soccer all day, every day. And if they're not, you know, in school or playing soccer, they're watching it. So this passion for this game has now made it one of the marquee sports of the city.
And it also kind of rejuvenated Coach McGraw, didn't it?
Yeah, he's a man who's in his fourth decade of coaching and teaching biology, and he's someone that was on a quest for a state title. You know, he'll say, I don't need it, but I really, really want it. He'd made it to the championship game once back in 1991 and lost, and as his roster diversified and started playing a much different kind of soccer, it looked like his hopes to hang on there and do this were going to be worthwhile. And 2014 and 2015, they make these championship runs and are finally successful.
So how did they adapt and the school adapt actually to becoming really a place where a lot of people there were non-English speakers?
Yeah, and not necessarily literate non-English speakers. So what's called a population of low literacy adults, that simply translating things onto paper and sending information home was not necessarily going to cut it. One of the amazing things that you see school administrators figuring out how to accommodate language and interpretation and communication, things that are always in process. And you see members of the Somali community stepping forward and creating organizations and support groups, you know, the Somali Bantu Youth Association creating homework help sessions alongside their youth soccer league. So if you wanted to play on this youth soccer league, you had to go to the homework help session, and then you could play soccer. I think I saw it described as a carrot, you know, to hang in front of kids. So it was these kinds of things. And one of the, you know, if you talk to Jason Fuller, who's the athletic director for Lewiston High School, he said, you know, these are our athletes, these are our kids, and we figure out how to accommodate. And I think that's one of the great things about this story, is that it's not sort of a traditional melting pot immigration story that we're so familiar with in the way American history is talked about. It's really a negotiation for all sides to figure out how to make it work.
I like that, a negotiation, because, I mean, the city did seem racially divided.
Well, yeah, because there's an ebb and flow to how that happens. And I think that it's a fragile detente that they have to work at. And there's painful moments, and then there's moments of coming together. And one of the things that I'm always pretty adamant about saying in terms of this state championship game, which really brought the community together, you know, some 4,500 fans sitting in those bleachers, which means it's not just the parents of the kids on the field, right? It's everybody. Is that, you know, just because a community comes together doesn't mean it stays together. But it's important that it came together, because then it knows what it feels like to be together, and you can keep working on that.
As that season, this is the 2015 season we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
As that season came together, the team was already a good team, and they usually went far into the playoffs. Was there enthusiasm building up as it looked like, hey, this might be the year?
I don't think there was any question that it could be anything other than the year. That season started the day after their loss in 2014. In 2014, they came in as the number one team, and they lost to the seventh seed in the final. So it's kind of amazing. If you look at the sports coverage of that game, no one is writing headlines about Chevrous wins. Everyone's writing headlines about Lewiston lost. So I think they created a mindset over the course of the next year. They worked their heads off, and they have an undefeated 2015 season in which they outscore their opponents 114-7.
Wow. Okay. That's a good year.
I mean, it's funny, because a lot of Americans will say, no, I don't like to watch soccer. It's too low scoring. And I'm like, well, you should go to a Lewiston game, because that's not true.
What kind of access did you have to the players and the coach?
They were incredibly generous and open, and, you know, locker room and halftime huddle and pregame strategy sessions and, you know, kitchens and living rooms and hanging out, incredibly open. I spent a lot of time in Lewiston, and I kind of had to take off my research agenda hat and just hang out and sort of be present and get comfortable, you know, not just going to soccer games, but going to track meets and going to football games and hanging out downtown so that I could, you know, be accessible and also, you know, let people come to me.
How long were you there?
This book took about 2 years. It was a solid year of research, and then adding on about 8 months of writing. So I was back and forth for about 15 months, with a good 2 months right in the middle of just being there.
Who were some of the kids and families that really stood out to you?
You know, they all do in different ways, including ones who aren't featured, you know, with all that much focus in the book, because, you know, you do have to pick and choose your stories. But, you know, you look at somebody like the character Abdi H, who's the greatest soccer player the state of Maine has ever produced. And he's this thoughtful, introspective kid, a captain, a leader, but quiet and an incredibly unselfish soccer player, which I think speaks volumes to him or about him. And then you have kids, you know, newer kids who are in the postscript, who are part of the championship team that they just finished their season with this past fall. Someone like Bilal Hirsi, who is the son of Abdullahi Abdi, who is one of the community coaches. He coaches the eighth grade team. He coaches the summer team alongside the high school coaches. And he's really, as they all say, he's the coach of everyone. And so you have someone like Mike McGraw, the varsity coach at the high school, partnering with somebody like Coach Abdi. And then having someone like his son, Abdi Jabbar, serve as his assistant coach, and having someone like Bilal, his younger son, on his varsity roster. So you have these just wonderful connections and conversations that are ongoing that I think really set examples for everyone to look at.
You talk in the book about the national political situation that was unfolding as this season was unfolding. How did that affect the players?
You know, for that 2015 season, they're very adamant about, you know, they got some national attention. They get a national ranking, which is, you know, they're the only team in Maine that's nationally ranked. So they shut out a lot, I think, to focus on soccer. And I think that that's good. I think shutting things out is sometimes good. But, you know, this was the lead up to the 2016 election, which I certainly talk about at the end of the book, and the impact of that election on a place like Lewiston, and the impact of the more overt and disturbing conversations that we're seeing in the United States in terms of immigrants and refugees and quotas and walls and things like that. So I think, you know, when I started this project, it certainly felt relevant. As I was writing it, it felt increasingly relevant. And I have to say, it, you know, having it come out this week, it feels almost overwhelmingly relevant.
How have the subjects of the book reacted to the book? And do you keep in touch?
I am in touch with a lot of them. They're off doing their thing. Some of them are in college. Some of them are in Lewiston. You know, most of them are still playing soccer in one way, shape, or the other. They've been really generous about it, and they've always, you know, while writing it, to have that kind of an audience sort of in the back of your head, making sure that I did their stories justice was really important to me.
Well, I see on your book tour schedule, there's Lewiston Library right there. You looking forward to that day?
I am, and even more so, I'm so excited that Lewiston reached out, and I'm glad it's the library. It's downtown on Lisbon Street. I think it's the perfect venue, and even before that event, I'm going to have an event at the Maine Immigrant and Refugee Services, which is what the Somali Bantu Youth Association turned into. So it's one of these Somali-founded organizations. Some of its founders are main characters in the book, community leaders like Abdi Kadir Negi, and I'm absolutely thrilled and can't wait to go and be there with those folks and put the book in their hands and get to thank them.
Again, the name of Amy Bass's new book is One Goal, A Coach, A Team, and the Game That Brought a Divided Town Together. Still to come, the cost of college is rising in Massachusetts and families are feeling the pinch. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. A recent report from a left-leaning research center said student loan debt has been growing rapidly for graduates of Massachusetts' four-year public colleges and universities. The report from the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center says funding for public higher education in recent years has shifted from the state budget to students and their parents. The Best of Our Knowledge's Paul Tuthill spoke with the center's president, Noah Berger.
What we see in this report is that over the past 18 years, as state funding for public higher education has gone down significantly, tuition fees for students and therefore debt has gone up very significantly, increasing 77% over that time period.
And so just to be clear here, we're talking about debt at the state's public universities, correct?
Yes. This report focuses on our public colleges and universities. And we see that over the last 18 years, there have been deep cuts to state funding. That's led to higher tuition fees and to students taking on significantly more debt. Debt is up 77% at those schools for the students graduating. And the reason that matters is a couple of things. One, if you think about our state economy, more than any other state, we depend upon having a well-educated workforce to have a strong high-wage economy. And in fact, the good news is that we have the best educated workforce in the nation and the highest wage economy in the nation, and that's a good thing. The danger is if we don't continue down that path, if young people start to be deterred from getting additional education because of enormous financial obstacles, that could mean in the medium term and the long term, businesses aren't able to find the workers that they need and aren't able to grow and expand and make Massachusetts the kind of state where people can get good high-wage jobs.
In other words, people would be discouraged from going to college at all.
Yeah, I think there's a very real danger that as tuition fees get too high and people see the threat of really large debt loads, either they may not go to college at all, or they may begin and find that they have to work so many hours to be able to pay the tuition and not go too deeply into debt that they aren't able to put enough time into their classes and aren't able to graduate. And that is a real problem we have in our schools in Massachusetts, is that students often need to work such long hours that it interferes with their ability to progress in their education.
What's the average amount of debt that someone is graduating from a public university with today?
The average debt of people graduating from our public universities now, of those who have debt, is about $30,000 per person. And that is climbing and is now close to the debt level that people who are going to private colleges and universities have.
How does Massachusetts compare with other states in their support, taxpayer support for the public universities?
So it really depends upon exactly how you look at it. We are a very high income and high cost state. And if you look at the percentage of our income as a state that we put into funding higher education, we're at the low end of the nation. We are still, with that small percentage of our income, able to spend more on a per pupil basis than a lot of other states because we're a much wealthier state. But the big change over the past 15 years or so is that we had been one of the lower cost states with kids graduating with relatively low levels of debt. And since 2004, the amount of debt that students graduate with has increased more in Massachusetts than in all but one other state in the country.
And this is a direct result of there being less state funding going into higher education?
Yes, the state funding for higher education has gone down significantly since 2001, and as a result, tuition and fees have gone up. And if you look at the numbers overall, the funding per pupil has gone down by about $3,000. And tuition fees have gone up by about $4,600. So the cuts in funding don't explain all of the increase in tuition fees, but they do account for about two-thirds of it.
I know that the state funding has gone up and down, and I know it took a major hit during the recession in 2008, but hasn't it been increasing somewhat since then?
In recent years, once you control for inflation, it's been pretty flat. It increased a little bit a few years ago, but since then has been going up at a couple of percent a year, which is roughly in line with inflation. So we're not making up much for all the lost ground when we had deep cuts.
What's the argument that you would make to state budget writers for making funding for public higher education a higher priority?
I think it's just important to think about what the future of our economy looks like. And we are a state where our economy is strong when we have a well-educated workforce that allows companies here to thrive and to grow and to prosper and to create good jobs. And I think that is important when we think about the future of our economy and the ability to be the kind of state that we want to be. And it's not just about our economy. It's also a question of whether kids who grow up in any community in the state who work hard and are ready for college and want to do that hard work to get a college degree, whether they'll have that opportunity. And if we make sure that opportunity is available and is affordable, that allows for us to be the kind of state where everybody can reach their full potential. And that's good in terms of the message that we send to kids in high school about working hard and trying to achieve things. And it's also really good for our state economy if we can be that kind of state where we have the best educated workforce in the country. And it's more important than ever. Throughout American history, there have been times when other things have allowed a state to be strong economically, whether it's, you know, manufacturing or natural resources. And there are still states that do well in those areas, and there's some manufacturing in Massachusetts. But even manufacturing jobs now require well-educated workers. And more, the states that are really successful are those that are serious about making sure all of their people have access to high-quality education, and they create really highly educated workforces.
Noah Berger is the president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Paul Tuttle. Why is there no right to education enshrined in the U.S. Constitution? Glad you asked, because that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Why isn't education a federal right? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Derek Black, professor of law at the University of South Carolina, looks into this question.
Our federal constitution is an outlier when it comes to education. State constitutions and the vast majority of other countries' constitutions mention education, but our federal constitution doesn't. With no federal accountability, states can drastically cut education budgets, suspend students for minor misbehavior, and ignore troubling achievement gaps. State courts in places like Kentucky and New Jersey are relatively successful in forcing improvements in these areas, but bad examples outnumber the good ones. The practical results are vast educational inequalities both within and between states. A federal education right offers a solution, but establishing that right has proven elusive. Federal litigation has been so unsuccessful that it was basically abandoned a few decades ago. Amending our Constitution would be very difficult, and new litigation is not much easier. Even with this knowledge, this past summer, advocates decided to try again. Independent plaintiffs filed cases in three different states with three different rationales. These cases, however, still need to offer new and convincing responses for a skeptical set of judges. My research shows the events immediately following the Civil War provide answers. Congress was trying to transform the slaveholding South into a working democracy and ensure that freedmen and poor whites could fully participate in it. Congress passed the 14th Amendment, which guaranteed citizenship, equality, and due process. But Congress also used its power to set the terms of Southern states' readmission to the Union. Through that power, Congress demanded that Southern states establish public education systems. Congress believed that voting and education were absolutely necessary in a democratic society. In fact, in the century following the Civil War, no other state ever entered the Union without guaranteeing education. This history demonstrates that, although never explicitly articulated, education was originally understood as a right of citizenship.
That was Derek Black of the University of South Carolina. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.